This week on the Woven Energy Podcast.
So George and the Dragon, you can go and lance the miasma if you want to have a go at it. Best of luck with that one. Or you can sneak past while the thing's sleeping, can't you? And that's what the secret societies were about. If we want to look at, you know, myths, well, you know, the biggie, the one we should cover off straight away is Adam and Eve, isn't it? Obviously, it was Eve that sorted that out, you know? It wasn't going to be Adam, was it? You know, Eve succumbed to a wicked... Again, you see the male domination in the culture behind it, you know? And then Adam despicably blames Eve. come on, take some responsibility, mate, you know? There's people out there billing this as a positive message, you know? How? In what? You know, for instance, in ancient Egypt, you would get a token title from the king, you know, or from the pharaoh, you know, like the deputy chief assistant supervisor of the royal toilet or something, you know? It's like, and they won't admit that even to themselves, because that's a very painful thing. It's almost like them saying, I'm wasting my life. You know, you can see in the Western magic tradition, you know, that the stuff that ended up with Paul Daniels and all these kind of guys, if you trace that back, it grew out of esotericism. It grew out of guys like the Rosicrucians. But, you know, all this to say that the miasma can result in some pretty horrific stuff happening to people, that, you know, the kind of stuff that whatever negative things shamans have tried in the past, they can pale in, tiny insignificance compared to the horrific shaman things that exotericists are done, you know?
Hey guys, and welcome to the Woven Energy Podcast on real, practical, non-navel-gazing shamanism. My name's Joe, and I'm here once again with Damon Smith, and our mission, as always, is to paint a complete picture of shamanism in all its many shapes, sizes, and guises, what we've been calling shamanism from the ground up. I am pretty excited about this episode. It's going to be a great one for me personally, considering the topic. Now, shamanism is an interesting topic. One that is either completely misunderstood or outright dismissed, and with good reason, you know, considering the amount of fluff out there. My point being, sometimes we need a door in, we need a way into shamanism, an angle to approach it which challenges our preconceived beliefs about it and kind of gives us a fresh perspective. This is a topic which slowly started to open my world up to shamanism. And, you know, I consider myself an atheist, a pretty strong one, and I probably still am, according to many people's definition of it, I guess. So I had a few barriers. Anyway, before we get going on that, I want to lead into this with a little observation I had a week or two back. Facebook is a necessary evil. Facebook is somewhere I have to be to promote various things I'm involved in, including this podcast. But a post came up on my feed from an old friend of mine. And it was a picture of a nice box, like a posh looking, but clearly kind of cheap, like cigar box or something. And inside on proud display was this badge which said 5 years loyal service. And this person, I won't say the name, posted this box and badge up rather proudly, you know, and the box said, Tesco. Now, you know, people have their own circumstances and that, and I'm not one to judge too harshly, I guess. But one of the comments in that little Facebook thing stuck out to me, and it said, oh, you got a badge. I didn't get mine. And this kind of got me thinking of how we buy into these things, these organizations in society. It's like, you know, keep spinning the hamster wheel and we will throw in the odd treat now and again, a badge, a hat, a new band on a lapel or something. And all the while we continue to be happy about doing all this for some reason, like it's normal. And it's always kind of seemed odd to me. But the reason I bring it up is because just as in society, and just as society has these structures and organizations where we can be good, happy little workers and receive our treats, the same has been going on since the dawn of civilization, or maybe the dawn of agriculture, or wealth, as we now perceive it. So myths and legends are weaved into our society, and in the same way teach us to be good little workers, and instead of a badge, you get a nice place in heaven for eternity, or there are such nonsense. And so we have these myths, you know, like we all know them, like Jesus walked on water, Muhammad split the moon, water into wine, or even lots of like symbology, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And whilst these have a surface that most people buy into, some have a more esoteric meaning, which when you know what to look for is quite clearly shamanism. And that's what today's episode's all about. So I think we decided to explore a few myths and legends from the point of view of shamanism. And my hope is that these examples will provide you guys with either a door into shamanism. I mean, you're listening to this podcast anyway, so you're already one foot in the door. But at the very least, some supplementary kind of background to this funny old world of shamanism as well. So over to you, Damon. I'm looking forward to this. Is there anything else you want to add to my rather long and rambling introduction?
No, other than that, I think your reference to agriculture is a particularly pertinent one. The rise of agriculture and pastoralism, you can think of pastoralism as effectively agriculture with animals, right? Mm. The rise of agriculture and pastoralism as opposed to a hunter-gatherer lifestyle was really the first impetus to what we've been calling the exoteric worldview, the hierarchical worldview, the worldview in which we, the ordinary people, buy into a whole bunch of things. You mentioned a list there, and keep the people with the wealth in their place, their elevated place within society.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily wealth of that kind. I mean, you know, famously, various societies have tried to equal things out in a fairly mechanistic kind of way, which isn't the way to do it at all. My opinion, the way to do that is cultural. But in a mechanistic kind of way, you know, communism would be a great example. And effectively, all they do is, because they're still focused on mechanistic models, hierarchical models, they effectively create a new type of wealth, which is like social privilege, if you like. Yeah. And it doesn't really work. All of that stuff came out of agriculture and pastoralism. I guess you could say when pastoralism came along, you had lightweight versions of that. You started getting extended clans and clan chiefs and that type of thing, people whose status within society and hereditary leadership and these types of things were still perpetuate in the world, parts of the world today. For instance, many, many different secret societies and less than secret societies in Japan today are actually, even though they're esoteric, they're still led, they still have a hereditary leadership. Which I find kind of ironic and slightly amusing, you know. And you can see this in the Old Testament, you know, Moses and various other people, you know, this idea of heredity from Abraham and, you know, and King David and all these kind of things, this idea of elevated status through heredity, all of that stuff came from pastoralism and agriculture. And obviously in the Old Testament, a lot of the key figures, they are either pastoralists or agriculturalists. But, you know, esotericists want to preserve what went on, want to preserve the skills and knowledge and understanding that their forebears who were hunter-gatherers had. They want to preserve that for the future benefit of human beings. And in doing so, because, you know, esotericists are always vastly outnumbered by exotericists, and exotericists can be extremely dangerous. Historically speaking, one of the main places they've done this is try to preserve something of their heritage inside these more exoteric types of groups. And one, I guess, the myths of these groups are one of the places where they've done this.
Hidden from the exotericists as well, right?
Yeah, because they believe that this is, you know, that they believe that this is part of what they believe in. And, you know, these things are always couched in terms that can have an exoteric and an esoteric interpretation. Mm. And that's the perfect place to hide what went before. And also just, you know, when these things were made, with, you know, a lot of the stuff in, for instance, in the New Testament, when it was written down, it was being written down by people who had recently been converted to this new form of exotericism for things that went before. And they were still quite deeply steeped. Their social miasma was quite deeply steeped in what had gone before, and so elements of that come through. I mean, you can see that very, very strongly in the parts of the New Testament that are attributed to St. Paul, which is very large parts of the New Testament. What I mean is that the Christian groups tend to attribute those books to him. Mm. And this was a guy who had to deal with two groups of very, very male male-focused people, the Judaic tradition and the Roman tradition, both of which were quite horrified by women being in positions of power. And obviously, you know, for instance, the famously the figure of Mary Magdalene in the New Testament, some of the passages in the New Testament have been hacked around to almost comical extent, surrounding the, you know, Mary Magdalene was the apostle to the apostles, as far as the New Testament's concerned. But the passages around her finding the tomb and then running off to get Peter because she was a mere woman and she needed his help kind of thing, you know. And that if you look at the text, if you read it with a dispassionate eye rather than, you know, a sort of miasmatically conditioned eye, you can see that text has been hacked around by somebody who was being very, very, feeling very, very uncomfortable at the time when he did it. And there's quite a lot of evidence that Mary Magdalene or whoever that name represented in those days was a very, very significant figure, much more significant figure in early Christianity than perhaps is.
She's been written out. She's been written out of the story.
Well, they couldn't. My feeling is they couldn't write her out entirely because she was absolutely central to what was going on. In terms of, it doesn't mean I believe in what was being taught or anything like that, but I mean to the exotericism that was being taught by somebody who might have been called Jesus. This figure of Mary Magdalene was obviously completely central to that, and so she couldn't be written out entirely. But so I guess they just wrote her out to the greatest extent possible by hacking around this text, you know. And I go and read it for yourself, you know. But it's quite interesting. And, you know, we have the fourth gospel as well, you know. We have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and what they call John. But actually, you know,
you're laying down hints now, Devin.
You know, just briefly, we got Matthew, Mark, Luke, and the fourth gospel. The person who wrote the fourth gospel refers to themselves as the beloved one of Christ. And is obviously, you know, for instance, present at the crucifixion, where a male wouldn't have been able to have been, they would have been arrested. So, you know, I think there's a strong chance that not that I'm implying that I would believe it, even if it was written by Mary Magdalene, but there's a strong chance that that is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Mary. And again, it was written out, you know, And you know, just
well,
the very,
there's also
just
the Gnostic very Gospels as well, isn't there? I remember.
Yeah,
dipped into those a little bit, as controversial as those are.
That's right, and there's stuff in there. I mean, that's what survives, isn't it? Because anything that didn't comply, you know, in exotericism, didn't comply with the official line at a given point in time, was eradicated fairly forcefully, and so just fortunately, these things were buried in pots in the desert, kind of thing.
I think what you did for me was back in the day when we first started talking about all this, is you gave me a lens, in a good way. You gave me a lens to view this stuff through.
But I mean, all you can see with this stuff is an ongoing struggle. So, for instance, with the Gnostic Gospels, you know, an ongoing struggle with people who want a spirituality rooted in the real world versus a spirituality that's rooted in belief and faith and the miasma. And in every one of these communities, you have those two people, those two groups of people vying with each other. But of course, as time went on, the nature of our society, the group who were interested in the miasma and wanted to promote that, they were had the upper hand. They had the large numbers of people at their beck and call. Whereas and even within the Gnostic Gospels, there's a lot of variation. And within Gnostic Christianity, there was a huge amount of variation. And even just within that small branch, if you like, of Christianity, or large branch of Christianity, you can see this thing going on between the people who are involved when you read these texts. And that happened all over the world in every society. The same thing went on. So I guess if we want to look at, you know, myths, well, you know, the biggie, the one we should cover off straight away is Adam and Eve, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
So, and I think there's a lot, you know, I think if we address Adam and Eve in a little bit of detail, then the principles that come out of that, or the ideas that come out of that, they probably apply to just about any creation myth you're likely to come across anywhere in the world. But, you know, Adam and Eve obviously represent men and women, male and female, yang and yin, if you like, if you've seen them in the Adam and Eve order. And you get this in all all areas of the world, this idea that these two aspects of energy,
duality,
were involved in the creation, of the world. And, you know, the joining of yang and yin, if you like, the joining of these two types of energy, yang and yin just simply being two different experiences of the self-same energy, two different ways to experience it, a creative way and a receptive way. But the energy isn't, it's not two different energies, it's one and the same energy. And the universe in esotericism is understood as effectively an energy tapestry. You know, we talk about woven energy a lot on this podcast.
Yeah.
And Adam and Eve obviously represent that kind of idea. If you look elsewhere in the world, we get the same thing. We talked about Fushi and Nuwa. In Japan, we've got Izanami and Izanagi. In Mongol tradition, the Mongols believe they're, I think we mentioned, descended from the grey wolf, the blue-grey wolf, Bot Chono. And Guamaral, the fallow doe, again, it's the same idea. This kind of husband and wife partnership representing some aspect of the creation of the universe. And you get this in a big way in Japanese groups. You know, the story of Izanagi and Izanami. You know, the story is that originally there was just a huge ball of chaos, if you like, a huge universe of chaos where energy just moved around randomly in a fairly chaotic way. And then over time, in the myth, some of the matter congealed into a sphere. And what kind of you would describe as the pure elements rose to the outside of that sphere, and they formed the heavens. What I think we talked about Takamagahara at some time on a podcast as well.
Yeah.
What we would translate as the heavens, and then from that congealed sphere, if you like, it wasn't in the myth. It wasn't like solid ground. It was just like still this turbulent movement of energy. And you can think in scientific terms, this is the Big Bang, the expansion of the universe, and energy being fairly evenly distributed over time through the universe through its initial expansion. But then as the expansion grew, the energy started to clump together into different areas and form stars and galaxies and planets and this type of stuff. Mm. And so you can see an intuition in we call it in these myths in the same way. And then, you know, a reed grew up from the earth into the heavens in the Japanese myth. And the what's known as kuni tokotachi, which in some modern Japanese societies is secret societies, and even in some Japanese spiritual groups that are open, fairly open, kuni tokotachi is kind of a representative of what I call torrents. So in the trigrams terms, that would be a yin baseline, a solid midline, and a yin top line. That just represents the movement and transfer of energy, the movement of energy or the transfer of energy. And this movement or transfer of energy sprang up from the ground like a reed and extended up into the heavens. And then in the myth, this energy, this personification of energy, Kuni Tokotachi, created, two figures, surprise, surprise, Izanagi and Izanami, a male and a female. And then they cooperated. They descended onto what was known as Amano Ukihashi, the floating bridge of the heavens. And below them was this congealed ball of like swirling fog energy. And they pierced it with a jeweled spear. And, they formed Onokono, the first island of what used to be known as Yamato. Which is the old name for the heartland of Japan. And they pierce the ground. And this particular esoteric tradition believe that Yamato, what most people feel is that kind of heartland of Japan today is what's known in what's known as the Kansai area of Japan. And that's the area around the old capitals of Nara and Kyoto, and also the second biggest city, Osaka. And where they actually, so this spear sort of pierced the fog and created the first land, which was the first island of Japan in the myth. And then they descended down to this island and they erected a pillar to the heavens. And such a pillar still stands on what people believe is this spot. It's a spot called the Jiba. And the pillar is called the Kanwadai. Now, the pillar is very, very interesting in that it's hexagonal. And so that means it's six sides. Now, you think of the eight trigrams, each one of those trigrams has three aspects of yin or yang. in it.
Yeah.
And they form what's known as tatsu totsu. They form two in one pairings in this way of the female aspect or the feminine aspect and the male aspect coming together and kind of representing that duality in the creation of the universe. And so you take a six-sided shape that represents those two, three aspect things coming together. And you've people have probably seen the Book of Changes with its six, it's kind of stack of six lines. And this stuff's all interrelated. The shape of that pillar is very, very interesting. And there's a lot of meaning encoded in the shape. We don't really have a chance to go into it. But on top of this thing, the idea is that the legend or the future, there's kind of a future legend that's like a prophecy that they'll put a dish on top of it someday what's known as the jikimotsu will come down from heaven. Well, what's the jikimotsu? The jikimotsu is the esoteric knowledge of the universe. It's the teaching that comes from nature. This thing's in a big building, huge building. I've been to it. It's a very impressive large building. But the bit that's over the top of the pillar is completely open to the sky because, in the esoteric understanding, that jikimotsu, the knowledge of nature, is obviously going to come down from the clouds, from heaven, if you like, in a Western understanding. It's not going to come from human beings. So, and of course, an exoteric view of that, people who believe in the exoteric view of that particular pillar, they...
God will come down to this place.
No, it's more than that. It's like when we are pure enough and perfect enough human beings and we all really believe in a perfectly miasmatic kind of way, then the jikimotsu will come down,
Oh dear.
Of course, not realizing that is what they're talking about is moving as far as possible away from having the jikimotsu come down. We'll bring it down and obviously it won't, what they don't understand is that pillar actually represents human beings. It's Izanagi and Izanami personified, and they do this great in some branches of Shinto. There's a dance called the Kagura where they put on masks. It means like the heavenly music. They put on masks, and these people put on masks, and there's eight people who represent the eight trigrams, and then there's two others who represent Izanagi and Izanami, i.e. husband and wife, and or yin and yang. And they have to stand off to one side in this dance because obviously the spot they're supposed to be standing on is bang center in the center where the pillar is. So they sort of stand off to one side in this dance. And in the legend, when Izanagi and Izanami created the first, the first island of Yamato, and they descended down to that island, they decided to wed each other, and they built this pillar, and then they walked around this pillar in opposite directions, and then they faced, and when they faced at the other side of the pillar, they were wed as husband and wife, effectively the first husband and wife. Doesn't it sound like the Adam and Eve story, And and they do this kind of thing to this day. People still get married there, and they do a similar kind of thing. It's quite interesting how long that tradition has perpetuated in Japan. But coming back to the Adam and Eve story, there's certain aspects to this particular story that are quite informative. I guess the garden is the first one. The garden is obviously a metaphor for the fact that we didn't used to control our environment. We used to live out there in nature. We used to live in the forest or in the plains or in the mountains. We didn't control our environments like we do now in towns and cities and even in in rural areas, the agricultural areas. They are very, very controlled environments. The fields are maintained. And
so would you say the Garden of Eden is analogous to being and existing, being part of nature in terms of hunter-gatherer, just as we were as animals,
it's so obvious, isn't it? Yeah. And this is the creation myth, this is where we came from. But the interesting thing with biting the apple, the apple of the tree of knowledge and gaining knowledge of good and evil, like God in the exoteric interpretation of this story. So obviously it was Eve that sort that out, It wasn't going to be Adam, was it? Eve succumbed to wicked. Again, you see the male domination in the culture behind it, And then Adam despicably blames Eve. Come on, take some responsibility, mate, that's just one of the most despicable things there is, that story, anyway. But, in realistic terms, they're representing early human beings, aren't they? And biting the apple from the tree of knowledge represents forming the miasma. You know, it wasn't God that kicked them out of the garden. They kicked themselves out of the garden through their own actions. They were in this lovely, beautiful, wild wilderness. We talked about why a hunter-gatherer people's always smiling, yeah? When it's a story of dog-eat-dog, death, destruction, and what knows else, you know? They kicked themselves out of the garden. They created this alternative way of being, this miasmatic, hierarchical way of being. And effectively, they destroyed their own garden. They kicked themselves out of it, and they came up with a new way of living. And then you hear still in the first book of the Old Testament, you start hearing the stories about the wicked cities arise, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah and this type of stuff, you know. And there's all the stories about, you know, how wicked the people were because they didn't believe in God and all this kind of stuff, you know, and therefore they had to be destroyed. And then you get this kind of thing again, this you know,
control.
That fairly vindictive guy who kept wiping them all out, you know. Noah, he was awesome, you know. I'm not even going to go say what he does. It's so disgusting. But anyway, but if he was the best they had to offer, no wonder God wiped out the world, I tell you.
oh dear.
But anyway, let's not go there.
I've been waiting to get a little bit more controversial, though, Damon.
What really shocks me is how there's people out there billing this as a positive message. You know, how, in what, you know. Anyway, so coming back to Adam and Eve, you know.
Why were they told not to eat the apple?
Well, they weren't. That's the point, you know. It was like, it was their decision, you know. When we were hunter gatherers, and we found that we could create the apple by, you know, we could create the apple by effectively planting seeds. There was no God involved, was there? It was us, right? Yeah. It was us ourselves. So they weren't told not to eat it. I mean, I guess early on, one thing you could take that as an analogy for is there's evidence that a lot of people tried agriculture and then reverted to hunter-gatherer lifestyle because it was so horrible. I think, as it was said before, as an early agriculturalist, your life expectancy and standard of living were far shorter and less nice than as a hunter-gatherer.
If only they had these little badges, five years loyal service.
Yeah.
That's what they need.
Yeah, well, maybe. Well, they did have those little badges. That's the point. You know, you would get a token. For instance, in ancient Egypt, you would get a token title from the king, you know, or from the pharaoh, you know, like the deputy chief assistant supervisor of the royal toilet or something, you know. It's like, and these guys would slog their whole lives, you know, deforming their backs, working hard in order to get these petty titles from the it wouldn't be awarded by the pharaoh himself. It would be the pharaoh's assistant deputy, and that's, you know, you can still see that in stuff like the honors system in this country, where people get, you know, people get knighthoods and lordships and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, just jokingly also, they seem to be really bad at picking people to give knighthoods to. You know, I'm not going to mention any names, but do they ever seem to be really bad at it, you know? And it is, you know, and we talked, you give a lot of examples there in the introduction, these little tokens, these little things that are parceled out. You be good. I guess you're talking about, if you stay in hotels a lot, you get a silver card, then you get a platinum card, a gold card and a platinum card, you know, this type of stuff. And we buy into all of that stuff, you know. But
what gets me is, you know, not for me personally, but people are happy about this. It's like people are happy.
Hmm. I wonder about that. I think with the miasma, a lot of people have bought so heavily into it that they've almost convinced themselves. So I believe that there are quite a lot of people who actually aren't that happy, but they won't admit that even to themselves, because that's a very painful thing. It's almost like them saying, I'm wasting my life. You know, and you see this in career focus, you know, people who, you go to a company, They go to a company, they join a company as a junior, they maybe go in as the T-boy or something, and then they go up through the ranks through the years, they work hard for the company, and they get higher and higher in the echelons, and they get paid a bit more money each time, and they work 30 years for the company. And then the company has a reorganization and lays them off and doesn't bat an eyelid. You know, it's that kind of one-way company loyalty stuff. Another thing that happens, even if they do stay in the company, they get up to an assistant manager or something, and then some guy that's never worked for the company at all just gets hired in on basis of grass is greener syndrome, and he just gets hired into the company. He's like two ranks above them, and he's only just started, and they've been there 30 years slogging their guts out, you know. And it's
I was going to say
to their credit, Toyota as an organization don't do that kind of thing. They're very much Toyota is an example of an organization that not quite as bad as that. A lot of their very senior people come up through the ranks, you know, and a lot of their very senior people are actually good at the kind of things that Toyota do, like building cars, you know. So I think that's a credit to that type of a company, but they tend to be the exception rather than the rule in the world of corporate life. And so all I was saying was career focus, being career focused, people pour a lot into that. And also people who don't, I mean, another bunch of people, they just want the money, right? So they go and they do a pretty unpleasant, boring job, but at 5 o'clock, they're out of there and they go down and they have fun. They buy the biggest TV they can possibly afford, and they go and sit in front of the TV and have miasma drilled into their brain by the TV.
Put themselves in debt as well.
Yeah, and a great quote. I think it was from Duncan Bannatyne, actually, quite a famous entrepreneur. He said, just think for a minute. He says, when you're lying on your deathbed, will you be wishing that you'd watched more telly? You know,
it's really interesting. I remember reading an interview of a nurse who spent time with a lot of elderly people on their deathbeds. And she would ask them, you know, what do you feel? How do you feel? What's kind of in a better way? What's your biggest regrets? And they were all just... Most of them were just like, I just wish I spent more time with my family. I wish I didn't put so much time into the work. What did that achieve? And it's almost like they realised this at such a late time.
Wish I'd spent more time at the seaside or up a mountain or, you know, exactly the kind of things that shamans do, you know, shamans do every day. I spend a lot of time down by the sea, and that's just the sound of the water.
Do you think these hierarchies that we buy into is a base nature of human beings, or do you think it's an effect of the miasma on us?
No, it's definitely today I think it's just gained in inertia. You know, in this day and age, I think it's gained in inertia. It's been with us for what? Depending on which area of the world you're in, between 1,000 and 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years. Some very, very unusual areas of the world, maybe as far back as 9,000 years. It's very, very recent. When you think of, you know, human evolution going over a couple of million years, it's very, very recent. But it's been with us long enough that it's sort of become habitual, ingrained, and it seems like it's obvious. It seems like it's the obvious way to be, and it sort of becomes self-reinforcing, and I think a lot of the people who perpetuate it really do believe it, but I don't think originally it was like that. I think this, certainly from what I can tell from the old myths, you know, like Epic of Gilgamesh and all this kind of stuff, these old myths and legends that sort of cross over into history, I think you can get a hint that it was deliberate on the part of the advantaged people in society back in those days. And it just became habituated over time. But I think there was a certain amount of conscious thought went into how do we create a religion or worldview that perpetuates our status as the privileged ones in society. I think that very early on, maybe a couple of thousand years ago, that there was some conscious effort went into that. But by this time, I think even some of the people who do benefit from that maybe don't even see it in that way, and they're maybe not doing it in that way, consciously speaking, because the thing's gained in inertia, you know, like a big asteroid. You know, if a big asteroid's heading towards the Earth, if you wanted to stop it hitting the Earth, you could catch it early and give it a little bit of force to knock it off course. But if you had to catch it late, you'd have to do something fairly drastic to knock it off course. It's been going for so long now. And, you know, as esotericists, as shamanists, we're not trying to fight against that. You know, we can't. Every time we try to fight against that, we lose, basically. The story of George and the dragon is actually a very informative one as well. You know, if you think of the dragon as the miasma, George has got two choices, really, hasn't he? He can face down the dragon and he can go and lance it and kill it, you know?
Yeah.
Which in the story he did, but probably if he tried that in real life against the real miasma, he'd probably ended up toast, you know? If you look into the story, so again, I'm not going to mention what happened to the poor guy, but if you look into the story of the real St. George, he didn't meet a very pleasant end, it has to be said. Let's not go there, mate. Let's not go there. It's all about aspects of the miasma and the horrific things it does to people. This is a podcast on shamanism. We said we might do a miasma podcast sometime, but let's just stay off that. People can go and do their own research about St. George and his sticky end if you want. Mm-hmm. All this to say that the miasma can result in some pretty horrific stuff happening to people that, you know, the kind of stuff that shaman, whatever, you know, whatever negative things shamans have tried in the past, they can tiny insignificance compared to the horrific shaman things that exotericists have done, you know, and the scale on which they've done stuff, you know. Yeah. It's just about believing things, you know, stuff like the Holocaust, you know, sadly, I think that Hitler actually did believe some of the crap he was touting, you know, and that the fact that he believed that stuff and he was an exotericist is what made him do this horrific things. And you see this time and time again.
It's poisoning of the mind, isn't it? It's just
you see it with the Crusades, you see it with we talked about the Salem witch trials, you see it time and time again. And you know, whatever bad things shamanists have done, that, you know, even if you thought all shamans were bad and they manipulate people and that kind of stuff, they're just not physically able to cause, you know, genocidal levels of destruction. They're just not able to do that. And actually, my view is that probably if you looked into the history of shamanism throughout time, you'd find that the positive things that shamans did far outweighed the negative things. Where over exotericists, I have a serious question mark whether that's actually true, though I don't dispute that some exotericists do positive things. Yeah. The question is to whether those positive things outweigh the huge negatives that have happened through time. So George and the Dragon, you can go and lance the miasma if you want to have a go at it. Best of luck with that one. Or you can sneak past while the thing's sleeping, can't you? And that's what the secret societies were about. That's what esotericism's been about since the start. And you can see this in when they get found out, you know, the lessons were there. I mean, you take the Knights Templar, esoteric group, the Knights Templar. They got found out or some people knew that they were esotericists or that they had esoteric leanings. And then the political powers that didn't like them used that to convince the Pope to excommunicate them. And then they were all wiped out. And again, their leadership met very, very sticky ends. Jacques de Molay, and just look up Jacques de Molay. Again, I don't want to go into it. It's all pretty unpleasant stuff. So basically what exotericists do to esotericists when they find them out, that's what we said before, that's the reason why this stuff went underground. It's for safety reasons. In the West, again, the Freemasons, no different. The Rosicrucians, no different. So we're talking, I often talk about the Far East, but hey, in the West, it's no different at all, you know. So When these myths are perpetuated, again, you've got some people trying to get rid of stuff and some people hang on to it. And this sort of Adam and Eve thing, you know, the fact that men and women are, as a matter of fact, important within society. And, you know, a lot of these early societies are possibly matriarchal, you know. There's almost a denial of reality. Denial of reality becomes a part of a way of proving that you're a proper exotericist, you know. I remember that the former Bishop of Durham made a right stir when he said he didn't believe in the virgin birth, you know. And it's just like, you know, I mean, for goodness sake, you know. I thought, you know, if I was going to have a bishop, I'd choose that guy. You know? It's, you know, it's so, like there's something so special, you know, and then you see this thing again, you know, so we've got Adam and Eve, and then we've got Jesus and Mother Mary. They couldn't stamp out the yin aspect. They couldn't stamp it out. They knew that they had to suppress it. But, you know, people needed that. They needed that to be in touch with their past. They needed it. So what they did is they didn't get rid of it. They rebranded it. And that's what happened with Mary. I mean, it's often been commented that Mary's almost eclipses Jesus in certain branches of the church in terms of importance, you know. And that's if you like, the ancient religion that revolved around the Earth Mother. The Earth was seen as the nurturing womb of human beings. And the Earth Mother is effectively encoded in Mary, in the I mean Mary the mother of Jesus. And there's a lovely carol about this, which is three ships. So look that one up and read the lyrics. Incidentally, on the things about Christmas, and you know that they were all ancient rites revolving around esoteric rites revolving around the seasons of the year, Easter, all these kind of things. These things predated Christianity by a huge margin. But again, Christianity knew it couldn't get rid of them, so instead it kind of co-opted them. And it's not just Christianity, other exoteric religions, Buddhism, what have you, have done this in other areas of the world.
It sort of took them as their own.
Yeah, very amusingly, when Buddhism moved into Japan, it's all these Shinto deities, you know, these Shinto spirits, which were, you know, the spirits of rocks and mountains and trees and all this kind of stuff. And instead of saying, no, that's wrong, we've got all our Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and what have you said, they just said, oh, these guys are all subordinate deputy directors of the, you know, the Institute of the Toilet of, you know, the of the Bodhisattva, you know. They all became subordinates in their hierarchical pantheon, you know, just paralleling exactly what happened in the West. And it's almost comical, really. You know, you get in the West, you get, for instance, you're out at sea and, you know, there's some electrical activity going on at the top of the mast, and it looks quite unusual, looks quite interesting in the dark. And somebody says, oh, what's that? And he says, oh, that's St. Elmo's fire.
Oh, dear.
You know, and what's this ancient druidic well or spring, you know? What's that? Oh, that's St. Margaret's well. It's just almost like you just slap a saint's name on it, you know, and then it's yours, you know. And, you know, what happened, you know, in Ireland, famously, Ireland was converted to Christianity incredibly rapidly. But actually what happened was that they simply went through all the pagan groves, you know, what you would call the pagan groves, the old folk religion groves, and they just turned them all into churches, you know. And it was actually a change of leadership. It was the leadership got converted to Christianity, and then everybody else converted whether they liked it or not, you know.
And that's one thing about these people that convert people. They're very smart at what they do.
Yeah, it's absolutely, when it's a hierarchical society, you target the people at the top of society. And, you know, Constantine would be a great example of that, you know. And also we get hints of stuff. We talked about the Holy Grail, the Arthurian legends and the Holy Grail. You get hints of stuff like that, you know. You get stuff like Chalisti in there, you know, the Grail, as we said, you know, Galahad achieved the Grail by becoming the Grail, i.e. achieving Chalisti. The Grail's an empty cup, you know, in a way. That's why we picked the term Chalisti as a translation. You get this type of stuff, and the quest for the Grail effectively is a quest to get away from, to slay the miasma inside you, or to suppress it to the point where you can allow your cup to be filled, allow nature to come to you and return back to you in some way, in some distance, to return back to your natural way of being, you know. So,
okay, shall we bring this back to the Garden of Eden for a bit?
Sure. Well, I don't know.
We're going on various tangents.
There's not a lot else to say about it, really, except the poor serpent. I guess we could mention the poor serpent. So, in the Western tradition, certainly in ancient Rome and Greece, the serpent was a symbol of medicine. Remember, we said a lot of shamans were also into herbalism and medicine and helping people in that way. And for whatever reason, this serpent became the symbol of that. So, and I guess that possibly goes back quite a long way. But again, you can see the, you know, the wicked, evil serpent god, you know, this kind of vindictive, exoteric god says, oh, you need to crawl on the ground on your belly because you persuaded the woman to persuade the man to, you know, it's just like the blame game gone mad, you know, and you see this in a lot of organizations with bad management. You see the blame game going on a lot. The managers come in and the things aren't, they're not happy and they want to know who's responsible, and they have a, you know, a great hoo-ha over who's responsible, and then the people get reprimanded, and then everyone, because the managers are behaving like that, then the staff all start behaving like that, and they all start blaming each other and backstabbing each other and all this kind of stuff, and then their performance just nosedives in that kind of environment, and then the managers get really frustrated that they're not performing and they need to buck their ideas up, not realizing, of course, that it's the managers setting the example, the bad example of bad management that's caused all of this in the first place, you know. And you know, when I'm teaching people in the business environment, very often I'm encouraging managers to become servants of their teams. And again, here's the myth about Jesus doing just that, you know, washing the feet of his disciples. You know, it's not the sort of thing that you would expect a leader in a very hierarchical, exoteric tradition to do. And I think that also shows you that the branding of what, if Jesus existed as a person, little stories like that, let he is without sin cast the first stone, little stories like that, little anecdotes like that, to me, they sort of demonstrate that if this really was a historical person, he's probably quite a bit different from, his worldview is probably quite a bit different from what's billed today as, you know, Christianity. But in what way different, I don't know. But they don't seem to sit with the enormous hierarchical stuff that goes on in the miasma today. You know, for instance, the example is the divine right of kings, you know, which we've got also in the Arthurian legends, haven't we? You know, Arthur goes along and the Lady of the Lake sticks her hand out and hands him the sword, and Excalibur, he pulls the sword out of a stone. Some of the legends is not clear whether it's the same sword or not, but you know, but the point is that this is an indication that he's been divinely blessed and given this special position in society, you know, nothing based on merit, you know. What would be a much better story is he strove hard and he worked hard and he did good things for the people, and they sort of promoted him on the basis of merit. No, you don't get anything like that, you know. And I think in one of the Monty Python movies, I think it was Eric Idle, he said, was it aquatic females distributing swords is no basis for a form of government, you know. And I thought, which I thought was just totally to the point, you know.
You've got to have one foot in reality, aren't you, with this stuff? And it's like, I remember having various debates and kind of semi arguments with my uncle about this kind of stuff. And I'd be like, you know, Jesus obviously didn't walk on water. And he'd be like, but you don't know, you weren't there. You know, that age old argument, you know, you don't know. Actually, I have got one foot firmly planted in reality. And just like I know I'm not going to stand up and walk through that wall over there, I know that physically, and you know, it's not possible. He won't have worked on what. So from that higher point, from that different kind of lens, I guess, that I can view it through, I'm like, well, what did it actually mean?
So certainly to people who are credulous, people who are bought into the miasma, certainly a shaman, a good shaman, if you're a member of a animistic community that's starting to move over to, remember we talked about this process of them gradually moving over, or maybe not even gradually, sometimes rapidly moving over to exotericism. If you're a shaman in that community and you start getting the animistic people start believing things, they start becoming exoteric. At that sort of point in time, with a shaman's abilities and understanding of people, understanding of human nature, he could probably make you believe that he walked on water and that you saw him walk on water. Certainly, great shamans is able to achieve something like that.
Because he didn't
walk on water, but you now believe that he did.
And because
now
he uses the miasma.
Exactly.
Against you.
Probably also uses some shallow sandbanks or something like that, you know.
Oh, okay.
that you don't know about, you know, or put something under the water, you know. But the point is, he can make you believe that, you know, because the shamans are good at this kind of thing. And you can see in the Western magic tradition, you know, the stuff that ended up with Paul Daniels and all these kind of guys. Mm. If you trace that back, it grew out of esotericism. It grew out of guys like the Rosicrucians who were an esoteric group, you know, and the kind of things that they used to do. And it started getting used in a commercial sense. It started getting used by people to put on a show, to entertain people. And you see this in the Indian tradition now. You always see the guru with his long robes holding a stick, meditating while he's suspended in the air. So obviously sitting on a kind of iron chair that's going down inside his, with a leg going down inside his robes, that it's ridiculous. But if you believe all that stuff, you know, if you really, really believe it. So a friend of mine, years ago, he went on a course, who's a martial arts guy like me, he went on a course with a famous martial artist. I won't say who it was, but this particular famous martial artist, martial arts master, was demonstrating Kong Jing. Kong Jing is where you supposedly beam energy through the air and knock a person over. And this particular friend of mine was probably a pragmatic, sort of stalwart kind of guy. And so this guy beamed his energy at one of his own students. This master beamed his energy as one of his own students. The guy's eyes were closed and he was standing behind his back and the guy fell over. And everybody was like, wow, that's amazing, you know? Mm. And then he says he got a volunteer and he was turning towards one of his other students. And Jason I shouldn't have said his name, but anyway, the guy's name was Jason, sort of jumped out and said, I'll volunteer, kind of thing. And he stood there like the Rock of Gibraltar, you know, as this guy beamed his Kong Jing at his back. You know? And then the guy said to him afterwards, oh, you have to believe it. If you don't believe it, it doesn't work. I thought, you know, gosh.
So it's not his fault, is it? It's obviously Jason's fault.
But, you know, I'm just thinking if that was a proper shaman, you know, he'd have come up with a better trick than that, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, and then there's, you know, it's just, but the thing is, it's people want magic. One of my teachers said to me when I first met him, he said to me, that's what they're looking for. They're looking for magic. It's almost in a way in the martial arts, like you, a lot of us, me included, I guess, we just looked at Bruce Lee and we saw in the movies and we saw, oh, you know, when I was a young kid, I thought, oh, wow, if I was like that guy, if anybody gave me any trouble, I would just chop them and I wouldn't be afraid anymore, you know? And so you kind of get what you want out of martial arts, but you get it not in the way that you expect, you know? You think that the fear of somebody hurting you is going to go away through your ability just to chop people, you know, and you'll be so perfectly skilled that no matter what happens, you'll just get out of it effortlessly, you know. Yeah. You the fear does go, it does go, but it goes in a completely different way, you know. So you've been beaten up by people who are much more skilled than this guy who's attacking you. Effectively,
habit and repetition.
And the prospect of the force being applied to your body is a good deal less than it used to be. And you know, I've often felt like that. You know, when somebody's sort of hit me or punched me, you know, maybe they lose their temper a little bit or something like that. You know, they hit or punch me. I often feel like, is that your best you can do? Kind of thing. You know, it's kind of, you know, I've been hit there 100 times harder than that. You know? by guys who like me, you know.
Yeah.
but it's kind of it's kind of, we're conditioned to want that. And you know, the whole, we talked previously about marketing and all that kind of thing, and how the TV advertising and all that kind of stuff sort of reinforces all of this. You know, all I've got to do, you know, to be this successful guy is I've got to work hard, I've got to get my head down, I've got to earn money, and then I can start buying, right? I'll have the latest phone, I'll have the latest shoes, I'll have a great hairstyle.
There's little trinkets
I'll
to keep you
busy. I'll spray myself with this expensive smell, and then women will flock all over me, and I'll buy this expensive apartment, and it's all just stuff. And I tell you, all of that stuff, however appealing it is, right, honestly, all of that stuff, however appealing it may or may not be to you, and I'm not saying I'm a saint or anything, I mean a saint in the esoteric sense, that I'm not interested in any of that stuff, that's not what I mean. But what I mean is, you go down to the seashore all alone on a nice day where the waves are just lapping in, and you just stare out to sea and empty your head and look at the beauty, the clouds moving past the sea. There is nothing that any of those people will ever sell you that's as beautiful as that, that's as amazing as
so
that.
So long as you can see it. And that's probably the point of this podcast.
Not just seeing, you feel it, yeah? There's nothing that any of those people can give you or offer you that it may be okay what they're offering you, what they're giving you. It may be okay, but the bottom line is there is nothing. Or just the leaves on a tree, you know, or the just you run your hand over the back of a tree. There is nothing any of those people can give you or offer you to buy or anything like that that can touch that. Mm. And that stuff, if you want to think of it in an exoteric way, that stuff is totally free. It's there for you to go and get it. It's completely free. It costs not a penny. And it's there for you, the treasure, this great treasure of the world. And if you're, even if you view it in an exoteric sense, the richness, there is gold lying all over the countryside. You know, there is treasure lying all over the countryside. And you think about gold, yeah, people are obsessed over this gold stuff. Well, it looks all right, you know, and it does come from the earth and it's a natural material and it looks okay. But compared to a tree, you know, or a wolf or an eagle or the sea or a river or a stream, it's nothing. It's just rubbish, you know. It just looks like nothing.
It's shedding your perceptions and being able to appreciate it.
Yeah.
And I remember, it's interesting you brought up gold. I remember watching a documentary on the Mayans and the, I believe it was, well, was it the Spanish that invaded them? I think it was the Spanish.
Yeah, yeah.
And they literally just plundered all, like, they just invaded them for the gold. And the Mayans were like, yeah, just have it. We don't care. We're just like, I don't know what they did with it, but they just did not value it whatsoever. It was just dirt to them.
Yeah, yeah.
So, right, anyway, should we call it a day there then, Damon?
Yeah, mate, coming up on the hour again. You know, again, this sort of ended up being an episode of the Miasma podcast, didn't it, to a certain extent, predictably. Well, maybe we'll do that podcast one day. Maybe the one,
it's from some ways a different angle, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, in some ways it's good to address this stuff and get it out of the way. But, you know, as I said, you know, there is beauty and treasure scattered all over the countryside. Wherever you are, you can get to it by the seashore. Yeah,
this is episodes like this I'm really keen on doing every now and again, because it adds the depth, it adds the flavour, it adds the actual sort of essence of what underpins shamanism, I guess. And it's personal to me, because it's, like I said at the beginning, this is what drew me in, rather than, oh, you can go on this magical journey-like thing. No, there's so much more to it.
And I guess, like we've said lots of times, it's got nothing to do with imagination.
Yeah.
That beautiful sea, it's really there. Go and jump in it. You'll find out.
Okay, guys, thank you so much for listening. Head to the website wovenenergy.com, or you can email me at joe@wovenenergy.com. with any questions you've got. If you go to the website, we've got a episode that you can get hold of. It's an exclusive episode, and it goes a little bit deeper into a few more controversial things every now and again, and it tells you the very first thing you need to do to get started in shamanism. So get yourself a copy of that. Also, head to iTunes, and please, if you like these episodes and you've appreciated what we've done, please give it a review, or give it a 5-star review if you think it's deserving of a 5-star review. You know, reviews, how iTunes works, you know, it helps us reach more people, to help more people, which is what we're doing here. As you know, this is a non-profit at the moment, so we're just enjoying what we're doing. Thanks very much, and we'll see you next time.
Cheers, mate.
Cool.